I'm Eliza Skinner, and this is On the Podium on the BBC World Service, where Olympic and Paralympic champions tell the secrets to their success. We're just a year out from the next Games in Paris, where more iconic and inspiring moments will be created. And we're pretty sure some of our guests will be the ones making them. And if not, they've already left an indelible mark. As always, to guide me through this maze of amazing athletes is the BBC's athletics commentator Ed Harry and Paralympian Scout Bassett. We'll also test each other with challenging topics and conundrums whilst we shoot the breeze waiting for our guests to arrive. Speaking of which, enjoy! So, you know how when you're on the podium, they play the national anthem of the winning country? Okay, if you won a gold medal and you're on the podium and you got to pick what they played, so they didn't play national anthems, they just played your song. What song would you play? I know, right? This is your big moment. You gotta pick the right song. You can't mess this up. You can't pick Electric Slide.
I think it has to be an instrumental.
Oh.
Yeah. So I think it kind of has to fit the mold of the national anthem idea. So I'm thinking, like, I like a lot of TV theme tunes.
Mm.
And I can't believe I'm going to say this. How about I win the gold medal and then suddenly they start playing the theme tune to Hawaii 5-0.
Yeah.
I think that'd be awesome. Just awesome.
Oh my gosh. Okay, that's so funny, but good.
And I can just imagine if it's a live orchestra with like big drums and everything.
Wow, yeah.
So much fun. So much fun. It's orchestral. I'm convincing myself now, but I think that'd be epic.
I like that one.
Yeah.
It's a good choice, Scout.
I feel like a lot of the songs I would want them to play probably couldn't be played just because.
Oh, okay. You're picking explicit lyrics.
It's like E-rated, you know.
Okay.
Exactly.
We could also approach the performer to re-record it for you.
If they
were amicable to do that, they could re-record you like a podium edit.
Well, I was just gonna say I love Beyonce, so do I ask her to, like, hey girl, clean it up, send me a new version?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like you guys have that kind of friendship at this point, right?
Yeah, I'm sure I could just hit her up and we could get that next day.
My choice would be Moneymaker by Ludacris.
Oh, I like that. Would you do a dance while you're up there?
How could you not?
You'd have to.
If that's playing, not only am I dancing, everybody is.
Apart from maybe the silver and bronze medalists.
Well, no, it's that good a song. I feel like it would heal any wounds. They'd be like, this is a good jam.
Okay.
This also makes me think, as is with the national anthems, you know, if we continue to play those instead of personal choices, would there be a possibility of maybe doing some dance remixes of some of these national anthems? So when it plays, you still get like a party atmosphere. It's your anthem, but you're jamming.
The British one would be, can you imagine a remix of that one?
It needs speeding up.
Is that God Save the Queen?
The King these days.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
You get some instruments. Yeah.
Have some fun with it. The Jimi Hendrix Star Spangled Banner.
That would be cool.
Yeah, if you even just got to pick the version, yeah, the rendition, you could pick the Fergie Star Spangled Banner.
Oh, I've seen that video. I'm not sure about the Fergie version. Yeah, you've got to watch this. I'm like, oh, I wish I had.
Yeah, you're like holding your gold medal thinking, wow, it was so funny when I thought of it. Oh, well.
Here I am now. I should have played the theme tune to Hawaii 5-0.
Oh, can you imagine? Oh, my gosh.
Okay, time to meet our guest. Ed, who's on the podium?
Our guest today won marathon bronze at the Tokyo Olympic Games, becoming only the third American woman to win an Olympic medal in that event. And our guest achieved that feat in only her third marathon. No less valuable has been her decision to talk about the challenges she's faced along the way, the ones we don't see when we're watching her racing, those related to mental and to physical well-being. Molly Seidel, welcome to On the Podium.
Thank you so much for having me today.
We're really pleased that you're here. We have a few photos from your life that we'll use to guide our conversation. So let's take a look at the first one right now.
Molly, we are on the podium. That's the name of our show. And this is you on the podium with the gold medalist Peres Jepchercher and the silver medalist Bridget Kosgei of Kenya, both world record holders, one for the half marathon, one for the marathon. And there you are, proudly holding up your bronze medal. And I can see, even at this distance, a smile upon your face. Just take us back to that moment. Only your third marathon ever, and there you are on the podium at the Olympic Games.
It was such a surreal experience because, for one, in a typical Olympics, the female marathon medalists don't receive their medals at the closing ceremonies. It's typically only the men. But because of the logistics of racing the Olympics in the pandemic was, they flew us down. And so we actually got to receive our medals right in the middle of the ceremony. And it was just such a cool experience of walking out into that stadium after having been effectively just like so secluded all week. And everybody's there. Like, it's one of the pinnacles of my athletic career, like being able to receive that medal and stand up there next to two women who I just see as absolute legends in the sport. It was so cool. Like, my face hurt from smiling for probably like the next 3 days.
Yeah, we have a close up of it right there.
Yeah.
We've got a picture now of the biggest smile ever. Eyes closed, teeth, big, big, broadest smile, and holding up the medal there. I mean, I can't really stress enough how often, not all the time, but often, it's people of East African origin that win these races and place in these races and win medals in these races. So what was your plan going into that race? What were your expectations?
I think going in, knowing that I was really fit, my training had been going really well, but the marathon is a very long race and you can be the most skilled person in the world, but if you don't have a little bit of luck and if things don't go exactly right, it can be the difference between a medal or dropping out. And so I feel like going into that day, I knew that I had a good shot, but everything was going to have to go right. And I think I approached it with that mentality of like, okay, I'm going to just put everything I have out there and just see where I end up. And if I put out the best effort I can, I can't be disappointed with the results, because there were points in that race where I was pretty certain that I was going to get fourth. And that's probably the most heartbreaking place to be in the Olympics. But I think because I'd come to peace with the fact that all I could do was all I could do, it made it that much sweeter knowing that, like, okay, like, I gave everything for that race and I was able to come away with something that, like, I've dreamed about since I was a kid.
We saw in the photo right at the start that there was actually a little bit of a crowd because you were at the closing ceremony. What was that like to have some kind of crowd and some kind of a, because almost every other medalist at those games would have received their medals in front of maybe some teammates, maybe some coaches, maybe some officials, but and I realize it's the first time it's happened to you at the Games. How close was what you got to kind of what you would have been expecting had we never had the pandemic?
It, like, as weird as it sounds, it was almost like better than I envisioned it. Because normally you would just have the medal ceremony like at the marathon, probably like right after you finish. And it's like you just have the people who are there watching and getting to be surrounded by like all of my peers. Maybe that's what made it more special, is because all of those guys are athletes. They've all competed. They've all been through this like crazy 2 weeks that we've had in Tokyo. And so they so thoroughly get it. And getting to have Team USA teammates there, even the ones who aren't runners, I think it was just really, really fun and cool. And then getting to like celebrate that afterward. We had been in such strict quarantine the whole time that when we got back down to the village, it was just a crazy party. It was so cool because at that point it was like, okay, everybody's going home in 24 hours. We're going to let everybody like have fun with it.
This was your third ever marathon, but I am assuming not your third ever race. You had done some running before, just those three, right?
Yes, yes. So I think that was probably the biggest misconception. When I qualified for the US team, certain news outlets like the New York Times made it seem as if I had just like decided to start running and like done my first ever race at the Olympic trials. When like I had been a professional runner, I was a professional 5K and 10K athlete. I think it was just kind of that right away success at the marathon that really surprised people. And then people immediately see that and they're like, oh, wow, she literally just started running.
She just picked up a pair of shoes. First time.
I was working in a coffee shop in Boston to like help pay rent while I was training for the trials. And so people kept joking. They're like, oh, yeah, she just took a 2 hour coffee break and like went and ran the Olympic trials marathon. But But no, that was, I was a professional runner going into there. I am a paid full-time professional runner. I was actually trying to go for the 10K team at Tokyo.
And you just kept running?
But yeah, well, the marathon trials came before the track trials. And we're like, well, this will be a great way to get in shape. I'll be in great marathon shape. And then like, hopefully I'll have the speed to make the 10K team. And then all of a sudden I find myself getting second at the Olympic marathon trials. I'm like, well, that didn't go to plan.
Maybe I'm really good at this.
Molly, where did your love of running begin? When and where did it begin?
Yeah, so I grew up in a pretty rural town in Wisconsin. We had a lot of trails up behind our house, and I just loved going up there and just either walking or running. And it was the kind of thing where I was, now I know, I was a super ADHD kid at the time. I was just considered hyperactive. And so it made it a lot easier to just make my brain work when I was out like moving or running, and ended up joining the track team with my church. I begged my mom to do it. I did not come from a running family, and she still does not understand why I enjoy doing this, but she has always been so supportive of it.
I think we actually have a photo of some of your younger running days.
Oh, no.
No, these are good.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's a gem. I'm pretty sure that was in seventh grade. I remember those basketball shorts that I would wear in every race.
You seem to be leading a group of 11-year-olds in some sort of grueling race, 12-year-olds maybe.
You've got the face. You've got this kind of like determination, and the look is there, and you're at the head of the field too.
Yeah, my arms are all over the place though. This is how I am now. Like, as pro runners, we have to like really work on our form, and I'm looking at my form. I'm like, oh my God, what was I doing?
This is seventh grade. In fourth grade, and I bet people do this all over the planet, but you had an assignment and you wrote, I wish I'd make it to the Olympics and wish I'd win a gold medal. And so many people probably write that kind of thing, or I wish I scored the winning goal or the winning touchdown or whatever. But when you got to Tokyo and you did what you did that come back to you?
Yeah, it was actually kind of funny. My mom brought that card with her to the Olympic trials, and it is like kind of a funny thing that people are like, when did you know you wanted to do this? And it's like, I feel like from a very young age, even though I didn't have like a concept of what a pro runner is in my mind yet, I knew that this was it. My brain has always been switched on to like what running is and like how it makes me feel and just that love of going out and competing. So in fourth grade, I watched Dina Castor win bronze in Athens. That was the last time an American woman won a medal in the marathon at the Olympics. And so I think that's really kind of what started triggering that of like, American women can do this, and I want to do this too.
So you did have some family there at the Olympics with you, even though it was in the thick of COVID?
No. So the Olympic trials was in Atlanta in 2020, a week before the pandemic started. And my whole family came just expecting to see me run my first marathon. Honestly, I probably ruined their entire day because they were just going there to like party and have fun. Like, they posted up at a bar on the corner because it was laps. And then all of a sudden, every lap, I kept seeing my mom get more and more panicked until basically the third lap. She's just like sobbing and just non-vocal. And I gave her a thumbs up to be like, it's okay, I'm doing great, because I was in second. And after the race, she was like, you gave me a thumbs up and I didn't know if you were injured or needed to drop out. I'm like, Mom, thumbs up. That's the universal symbol of it's all good. But no, so for the Olympics, it was really hard because my family just been so supportive of all of this, and it meant a lot. But they posted up in Wisconsin, and as my mom loves to do, she threw a massive party that, as the race went on and more people started realizing what was happening, I grew up on a lake, and everybody started coming in from around the lake until there were probably about 200 people at this party. And NBC ended up being there and like filming the whole thing. It was really cool. So like, honestly, it probably worked out for the better. They got to see more of the race from the live stream than they would have in Sapporo.
I remember after the race, I can't remember which of the Kenyan medalists this was, but they were asked about you. And either Peres Jepchirchir or Bridget Kosgei said in that really clipped and polite but very firm way, something along the lines of, we didn't know about the American woman.
Well, it was very funny because they all know each other. They're all world champions. And then all of a sudden, this American girl who they've never seen is coming up there. And so like, there was definitely a little bit of team racing, and it was very much like I felt like I had to kind of pay my dues in that race because they were like, who the hell is this girl? Afterwards, it was really funny. Both Paris and Bridget were so kind to me, joking around. And then when I saw Paris in New York, she was so friendly and nice in the race, but it definitely was that kind of feeling of, okay, like they have no idea who I am. And they think I'm just some random girl who's come to try and mess up their race. And so it's like, I definitely kind of feel like I had to prove myself in that race with them.
You definitely did. You definitely did.
What was it like when you went home? Did everybody from the lake show up again or?
Yeah. So going back to Wisconsin was an absolute riot because everybody's been seeing me run on the county roads like for years growing up. And then I was always the crazy runner girl. And now like a really big source of pride just for our like lake community in our town. I mean, we've got like 600 people in the town. So like everybody knows.
The crazy running girl.
Yeah, exactly.
So you ran all through your childhood when, and you became more competitive with it on a larger scale in your college career, I believe.
Yeah. So I won nationals my senior year of high school for cross country. And that's how I got a scholarship to run at Notre Dame. But yeah, I started realizing that pro running was something that was actually a legitimate dream when I was in college.
You're listening to On the Podium with me, Eliza Skinner, Scout Bassett, and Ed Harry. Our guest this week is the USA's marathon medalist, Molly Seidel.
You were very candid, I guess, a few years later. You talked about, I mean, you won four collegiate titles. You won a couple of indoor titles. You won an outdoor title on the track. You won a national cross-country title as well, an NCAAs. You said afterwards, after you graduated, you sought help for an eating disorder that had been with you through those years through college. I guess there are two things here. What made you go and seek that help? And the second part of that is, it's a heck of a thing to share. So why did you want to talk about it as well?
Yeah, so with the going to receive help, I was at absolute rock bottom. Notre Dame did not have a very developed, I guess it was just the time back in 2015, 2016, there wasn't the awareness and the acceptance of mental health struggles, I think, in athletics. And so I had to kind of make the decision on my own to forego going professional after my senior year and instead going into treatment for an eating disorder because honestly, like I probably would have died. It was that bad. And if I didn't take it seriously then, it wasn't going to be that there was going to be no pro running. It was going to be that there was nothing after that, which is just a really hard, scary thing to face when you're like 20, 21 years old. And just the fact that there wasn't a whole lot of support around it made it that much more difficult. But I worked really hard. It takes a long time to get through that kind of stuff, but I feel like the support that I had from my family was so critical for me getting through that. And then after I recovered and was able to have the opportunity to run professionally, it took a couple years, but I eventually just felt like I was ready to like be able to talk about it and kind of come to terms with what had happened because I'd had to keep it secret for such a long time. It was something that was just surrounded by such a sense of shame for me. And I think talking about it with my friend Julia Hanlon, who she had a podcast at the time, and I didn't think it was really going to be heard by that many people. At that point, I hadn't really accomplished a whole lot at the professional level. I was more doing it for me, just unpacking it and taking ownership of my own story. I did that podcast and 2 months later, I qualified for the Olympics. And so all of a sudden it became this thing of just like, oh my God, like there's a lot of women, unfortunately, at the NCAA level who deal with eating disorders, who deal with this kind of thing that they win a couple titles and then you never hear from them again. I think what was really uncommon was that someone was able to come back from it. And I think that's why it picked up so much traction.
How do you feel about kind of falling into being a spokesperson for this? And at this point, like I imagine having to discuss some of the most difficult things about your life on such a large scale must be difficult.
It definitely is difficult. And I've struggled with it a lot, especially in the times that like I relapsed with eating disorder. I went back into treatment this past year and it definitely wasn't as severe as the first time, but it was so shameful again to feel like, wow, like people really look up to me as this like advocate, as someone who's supposed to be quote unquote fixed. And as people with eating disorders know.
Not really how it works.
No, it's definitely not. And the process of relapse and recovery is almost how you need to think of it rather than treatment and recovery. You are almost trying to just like extend the intervals in which everything goes to hell in a handbasket. And each time you learn a bit more, but it's so frustrating. You're like back at the bottom of the well and you're just like, why do I have to keep learning the same thing like every 5 years? But I'm a lot more comfortable with it now, especially being older and just with the general acceptance that there is now. I think a lot more people are realizing like, wow, like Olympic athletes and professional athletes are exactly the same as the rest of us. And they, if anything, we probably have a little bit more going on in our heads that makes us want to do these kinds of things. But the more people that reach out and say that like, hey, you talking about this has really helped me, that makes me more encouraged to keep talking about it.
I have been able to train with collegiate programs also, and you are right. There is a lot, especially in distance running, eating disorders, and just collegiate athletes in general struggling with mental health issues. I'm wondering, when you were at school and going through these struggles, were the coaches proactive in helping you get the help that you needed, or did you feel like they might have been a little bit dismissive of whatever struggles you were going through?
So I had two main coaches throughout my college career. My first coach, yeah, was definitely very dismissive, and my eating disorder really developed under him. It was a really hard time for a lot of us on the team. When my second coach, Matt Sparks, came in, who's now the director of Notre Dame, he came in and just like completely revamped the program. It became so much more positive, so much more accepting. And he almost is kind of like a father figure to me, or like a second dad, just because he was so supportive. And I was dealing with really bad bulimia at that point. And I felt safe enough to open up to him like, hey, like I need you to hold me accountable for this. And he really helped me through a lot of that, even when the rest of the administration very much was not, because they didn't want to lose their golden goose NCAA champion. But I think in the NCAA, just the general soup that you're in, it's just so difficult. There's so much negative imaging, and it's so difficult to go up against that, that as accepting as he was and as good as he was with that, he was fighting an uphill battle. And so I just kept going south, as eating disorders do. And because we didn't have any formalized treatment that we could do, it hit a point where he didn't know what to do anymore. And so I think that's the hard part of that time and place. There just wasn't the structure set up that I think there is now, of being able to, one, identify these things, two, get very specific treated help, and then three, just really be able to cut through, frankly, all the bullshit of the body image stuff, just the pressure that we put on kids at this point to like be performing at the highest level.
When you'd got your treatment, then you're kind of back on this road. So I'm going to be a professional runner. This is what I'm still going to do this. Was anyone in your family seeking to discourage you from that path? Did anyone in your family think, well, if this eating disorder sort of grew up alongside your running, was it the right decision to, obviously you make your own decisions, you're a grown up too, but to stand by and kind of see you go back into running, how were your family during that period?
The decision to go into ED treatment was my decision. I think my family, even somebody was like, no, you don't have a problem. You just need to like eat different foods, or like just be, and I'm like, no, like guys, this is really serious and I need to do this now. And it was really a point of contention for a while, until my family like sat down with my therapist. My therapist was like, if you don't figure this out now, she will die. But yeah, it was, I think I definitely wondered whether or not it was going to be healthy for me to go back into the sport. My therapist very much called me out. He was like, you can quit now, and like, you don't have to feel like you need to go back into this. If anything, your eating disorder will probably keep coming back as long as you are in this sport, and you have to know full well what you're doing. It was all of the outside influences, knowing that I was a high performing athlete, that I was very talented at this sport. A lot of people were pressuring me, and I actually received the messaging from certain areas that you have to make sure that you don't recover too much, because you still need part of this in you to be good at running. I heard that directly from someone. And that is really hard to take, of knowing like this is a sport that actively wants people to have eating disorders. And that's what's messed up.
I think that a lot of people would think that in order to be a high performance elite athlete, you have to have like this perfect relationship with your body. What is wrong about that? What would those people be missing?
My body is very much like I perceive my body as a tool. And I very much struggled with that at times because you see these images around you of the people who are winning and everybody has a certain look to them. And if your body doesn't necessarily fit that, which I have never seen my body as fitting that, I'm not one of these tall, lanky, graceful runners. I'm definitely like a little bit shorter, stockier, more muscular, like standing next to the Kenyans on the line. I look like Popeye. But yeah, it's the kind of thing where it's like you have to maybe not love your body, but come to terms with the fact this is how my body is always going to look. I can try and manipulate that, but the more I try to manipulate it, honestly, things will probably backfire. Anytime I've tried to manipulate my body skinnier because I think that's what I need to do to get faster, I get slower. So it's like I have had to come to terms with just what my body is as a tool for the sport that I am doing and find ways to make it as healthy as possible. Because I think that's the paradigm shift that it took for me is realizing like, oh, the fastest version of me is the healthiest version of me, not necessarily the skinniest. I'm just trying to get to a point where I'm like mildly okay with my body. I don't necessarily look in the mirror and I'm just like crushing it.
I think that's something that all women can relate to is, you know, there's always some part of us, right, that we don't love or we wish, oh, you know, was different. But oftentimes in sport and life, we see that success can really breed or lead to bad habits or unhealthy behaviors. And I'm just wondering if that was perhaps the case for you because you had a lot of success while you were in school and obviously going through your eating disorder. So there had to be a part of you that thought, I might be okay, or maybe this isn't really as bad, or I don't need to get help because I'm winning.
That, yeah, that's exactly it.
Okay. Yeah, that's what I was wondering. And I see that so many girls kind of struggle also in sports with this because it's like, well, I'm really successful doing this, even though I know it's not the best way to go about it, but it's working. Mm-hmm. So how did you like convince yourself? Because there had to be a part of you that thought, well, if I get help, I might not be able to be at this level again.
Exactly. So I truly believe that like success and achievement is a drug in and of itself. That desire to keep pushing to that next level, we see it as a virtue. We see things like diligence and dedication, all these things as these virtues, but in their own way, they are like a drug. They scratch that itch. And so it got to a point for me in college where it was just so much about like, I'm going to sacrifice my own happiness, my own relationships, my own health to get this next goal, to get this next NCAA championship. And it became that. It was like, if I just lose 5 pounds and I get this next NCAA championship, that's when I'm going to be happy. And I found that the more success came and the more I was sacrificing all these other things in my life, the more empty I felt, to the point that when I won my final NCAA championship, we were driving back and I just felt empty. And yeah, just nothing was ever going to be enough. And it was realizing like, it doesn't matter how many championships I win, it's not going to fill this emptiness that's inside me. And that was a really hard thing to realize, that I was going down this path. I'm willing to sacrifice my bone health, my mental health, all this stuff for what? A championship ring that I'm never going to look at? And it was a very tough lesson to learn. And I feel like I had to relearn that after the Olympics. A medal is not going to bring you joy. It's the people around you. It's this life that you've built that's going to do that.
Again, you kind of touch on the idea of like having a little bit of mental illness as a treat. Like how can I still kind of hold both of these? And it sounds like you have to really replace it with something else.
It almost is like a game of whack-a-mole. When you think you've conquered it in one way, it so quickly can like pop up in another way that you aren't expecting. When I finally got my bulimia under control in college, it just became restriction. It became over-exercising with me thinking I'm just really dedicated to this goal of winning NCAA championships. It's like, no, this is the exact same thing. You're doing it just as unhealthily, but more people are perceiving this as positive. And because people would tell me that, they would see me and they're like, wow, you look so fit. You are so dedicated to this. And now I see photos of myself. I'm like, geez, why did no one tell me how far down the rabbit hole I'd gone? My mom was the only one who like could kind of see it a little bit. But yeah, I don't know. It's just tough when you're just stuck in this very insular world.
You did also mention it affecting your bone health. And I believe at one point you woke up with a broken hip. Is that correct?
So yeah, the thing with either restricted eating or eating disorder, it super messes up your bone health. And so I have dealt with low bone density for a long time. And it's something that I still deal with today. Luckily, my bone health is up.
Nice.
Great.
So I have to get like pretty regular DEXA scans, and any like running in and of itself is already so much impact. It's really hard on your body. Even people with perfect bone health will break their sacrums and stuff all the time. I have to do everything I can to make sure that I'm like trying to get that bone density up. So I lift heavy weights. I do certain runs on low impact treadmills. But luckily, I've been able to still handle like pretty heavy training and pretty heavy mileage in spite of the damage that I've done in the past. So I think that would be the message that I tell to anyone who's recovering from eating disorder, that I definitely had doctors that were like, yeah, you're never going to run again after this. And I'm like, well, if I get my nutrition up, if I make sure that I'm getting like the right things in and not over exercising, like you can get your bone density up. But yeah, I've broken a lot of bones.
A lot of bones? Wow.
Yeah. It's very easy to look at the photo of me on the podium and be like, wow, everything must be great all the time. But then it doesn't show, oh yeah, I had a sacral stress reaction in March before the Olympics. And like,
I'm sorry, what's a sacral stress reaction?
Your sacrum is basically your tailbone. It's like at the very base of your spine. It's what connects your pelvis on the back. It's like a little triangle. And so, yeah, I had a stress reaction. So it's not a full fracture, but it was really painful. What I was like really worried, I was like, is this going to impact my ability to run the Olympics? So we took a couple weeks just completely off, kind of just took the risk, got back into training. And luckily I was doing all the right things. So the bone healed up and was able to do it.
I've heard that that distance running and marathons is just generally painful and punishing. Does that mean that sometimes it's hard to decipher like, oh, this is something we should really take a look at and just, well, it's marathon pain.
Yeah. So that's my relationship with pain is something that I've had to really learn, because I have like a crazy high pain tolerance that can sometimes really do me in. So one of the reasons why I moved away from professional track racing is that I actually ran on a broken pelvis for about a full year. Just didn't know. I thought it's just supposed to hurt like this. And I ended up needing to get a pretty major surgery in 2018 that put me out for almost an entire year. And so it's stuff like that where it's like my own hard-headedness I've had to learn to deal with and be like, okay, is this good pain from training, like something that I can work through, or is this like injury pain?
You've talked about having OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder, and also having a diagnosis for ADHD. Does knowing these things about yourself help you kind of regulate you? Almost like you can think, oh, I'm being like this now because of that. And suddenly a lot more things are making sense that maybe didn't make sense before.
Yes. So I had been diagnosed with OCD around age 18 and then had really struggled to understand why my diagnosis didn't fit necessarily fully with how my brain worked. And this frustration with like, I just feel my brain just doesn't function right, or that there's something wrong with me. And when I finally got my ADHD diagnosis, it made so many things make sense and gave me a lot more compassion for myself. Whereas I feel like there's always this sense of self-hatred of just like, why can't you just be normal? Why can't you just do things like other people do them? And everything kind of clicked into place where it's like, oh, this is why your brain works like this. And so working alongside my therapist, it's been so helpful to be able to put together a game plan, how I can work with my brain rather than this constant fight against it. Because I think how my brain works is in certain ways like really cool. Like it lets me do what I do in marathons. It allows me to just focus in on something so intensely difficult with this kind of like flow state mentality that I think is for most people pretty difficult to get into. But then like in my normal life, it's an absolute nightmare. And so it's like, it's finding that right balance of how do I keep this from spiraling into something really destructive. Like, that's where my eating disorder comes from. It comes from the comorbid OCD, ADHD. It's a really negative outgrowth of a need for control. But when I can channel it in the right ways, I feel like my brain works very quickly. I can process things really quickly. Honestly, I think that's why diagnosis is so important for people. It's that understanding and that compassion that you can begin to have, just the way that your brain might be a little bit different than other people's.
I have ADHD also, and I actually put off getting diagnosed for a long time because I thought, oh man, I'm going to be so upset that I didn't get diagnosed sooner. But when I did, I was like, ugh, this is why all of those things.
Well, and I just find it so interesting. I think so many women go either misdiagnosed or undiagnosed for a really long time because it doesn't necessarily fit the conventional way that we see male ADHD being. And like, I assume you were probably like me, of did super well in school. And they're like, you couldn't be ADHD, you get good grades. And it's like, that's not how it works. I've been shocked the amount of times eating disorder going along with ADHD, the sense of perfectionism, burnout. It's all these things that a lot of women are looking at themselves and they're like, why can't I just function correctly? Why can't I be normal? And being able to like recognize like, hey, this is something that goes really undiagnosed would be able to help a lot of people.
Yeah. And it's sadly coming at, people are starting to have that realization a lot more, right? As apparently we've reached some sort of tipping point where a lot of other people are like, there's too much ADHD. It's impossible. They can't be out there. I'm like, oh, right when women are getting our diagnosis. Okay. All right.
That's what it drives me nuts. Now you just have ADHD because it's cool. I'm like, I wish this was just a fact. That would make it so much easier.
You're listening to On the Podium with me, Eliza Skinner, Scout Bassett, and Ed Harry. Our guest this week is the USA's marathon medalist, Molly Seidel.
I think we have another photo.
Now, this is great. This is what you call a bit of a change of tone, a bit of a handbrake turn at this point in the episode. You're dressed as a turkey in this picture, and you're standing next to someone who's dressed as Father Christmas, so away you go. What's going on?
So the next to me is my brother and my sister, Izzy and Fritz. And when I'm home over Thanksgiving, we always go and try and do a turkey trot dressed up in costume. And I have my turkey costume that, as you can see in that photo, I'm going to need to replace it soon. The tail actually ripped off.
It's got some like taping, like masking tape under the arm. That's a poorly turkey.
The tape was holding the tail on because the year before the tail had ripped off when I tried to do my FKT attempt, the fastest known turkey. Yeah, I think this year I'm bound for a new costume. But yeah, I love getting to do that. There is nothing more fun that makes guys more mad than going out and beating semi-pro male runners while dressed as a turkey. What I will say is racing in felt is the worst material. Like, I understand why nobody runs in felt. It is so bad.
Not breathable at all.
Well, it's like a combination of like not breathable, but also cold, but also too hot.
So you can't get a high performance turkey suit?
All of these photos are from the Thanksgiving that I haven't had to do professional races. Typically, Thanksgiving is actually a very big day for professional road races. And usually I'm having to wear like my normal Puma outfit. So I'm going to try to convince Puma to make me like a high performance turkey outfit if I race like a Manchester road race or Silicon Valley 5K this coming year, because I feel like that would actually be pretty sick.
Yeah, you're working towards your own turkey trot. Mm-hmm.
I love doing the races in costume, though. We have one in Milwaukee for Bastille Day where I wore French like mime costume and then ran with a baguette.
Okay.
And oh my gosh, it was so much fun. And I like ate the baguette over the finish line.
In continuing with this lighter subject, you do have a couple of, I think it was in college, records in the beer mile.
Mm-hmm. So a mile on a track is 4 laps. And every lap you have to drink a 12-ounce beer before you run that lap. I will say that was run at midnight in jean shorts. So I think I could improve upon that time.
In jean shorts?
This is what happens. on college cross country teams when it's like midnight and you're like, you know, it would be really fun. Instead of getting Domino's pizza, we should run a beer mile. So yeah, I regretted that instantly.
Okay, but can I ask, were your laps 2, 3, and 4, were they faster?
So I ran about, I think I ran like 8 minutes and 20 seconds. So like, I think I could improve upon that if I wanted to go for it again. I think the last lap was definitely the slowest because trying to run with 48 ounces of beer in your stomach is so bad.
Oh.
Can we get the BBC to sponsor this? I will come over to England. It'll be great.
I could do it. I could do 4 laps.
Scout in.
I'll take it to my people. I will take, yeah.
Ed, you can commentate. We've got a plan here. This is going to be perfect.
I love it. I love it.
Speaking of these future plans, what are you looking forward to now?
So our Olympic trials for the US are next February. So I'm going to have to be like, all guns firing, stepping to the line in Orlando, February.
Oh, Orlando. Oh, come see me. I'm here in Orlando.
Oh my God. Okay. So we got it. Like, we can hit this up. We can maybe find like a distance in between the 100 meters and the marathon that we can like match up on.
That sounds like the exact distance that would be awful for both of you.
Because I'm not going any shorter than an 800. I'm going to say right out.
Oh boy. Oh boy. I might be crawling to that line, but we can maybe do it.
Yeah.
We can figure something out for sure.
We're going to be rooting for you in all of these trials and hopefully the Olympics. And it's been so wonderful talking with you. Thank you for giving us so much of your time today.
Thank you guys for doing this. It was really fun getting to talk with you all.
Talk about resilient.
Yeah, in so many ways.
Yeah.
And like Molly said, everything that she's talked about, everything that she's gone through suddenly came into this big sharp focus when she qualified for the Olympic team running her first ever marathon. But it's fantastic that we have come to meet her and come to know her and found out all this other stuff that kind of, because she said it could have been, couldn't it? You just see me smiling on the podium and you really have no idea everything all those years behind that, all the ups and the downs and everything else. My way into this story was commentating on her race. And I was just like the two Kenyan women. I was thinking, who is this? Who is this American? I have my notes. I'm like, oh, yes, yes, yes. But she shocked the world. She absolutely shocked the world. And she deserved every accolade and all the praise because it was fantastic. And then just to hear about everything else that goes into making the person and making the runner and how all of that has been for her was, yeah, just a privilege for her to really share that with us, really.
It's incredibly brave and courageous to be able to talk about some of the non-athlete struggles that people go through. And for her to be so open about that, I think is just super courageous because I know there's so many people that outside, you know, that look at athletes or look at somebody like her and think, oh, you know, she's a 4-time NCAA champion. She's got an Olympic bronze medal. How could she be struggling? There's a lot of people who don't understand or don't have a lot of empathy for professional athletes and whatever mental health struggles or battles that they go through. And I think for her to be able to talk about it brought a human element to her that I think a lot of people don't see in athletes, right? They only see the performance. They only see us when we're on the podium. And we're not really human to them outside of those spaces. And was really brave. And I think she certainly has helped many people and sharing her struggles.
I think also as social media has brought everybody closer to everyone of note, or made people feel like they have a right to be closer to everyone of note, once you're in that kind of spotlight, any effort to hide those things, hide such big parts of you, positive or negative, it's too much on top of everything else. So I think her ability to be forthcoming and transparent about that stuff, like a lot of people we've talked to, is probably part of what also makes her so good at what she does as an athlete.
Yeah, absolutely. And we haven't laughed that much as well and turkey costumes and all the rest of it. And that's clearly a huge part of who she is as well. And it's just so much fun. And I love the fact as well, though, that there is this turkey record out there
that she has established.
Maybe she's already got, maybe she hasn't. Maybe somebody wants to come along. Maybe her her apparel sponsor can make something out of the right kind of material and then...
That's it from me, Eliza Skinner, Scout Bassett, and Ed Harry. And join us next time for more of this.
Usually there's just such a big crowd and so much family and noise, but it was so quiet. And this podium moment and almost no sound was just so different from anything else.
The winter and summer Paralympic athlete Birgit Skarstein on challenging perceptions of disability in and out of the sporting arena. Next time on The Podium.
The global news podcast from the BBC World Service is...
What's been happening?
Who's involved?
Why it matters?
What might happen next?
I think what the global news podcast does really well is pick stories about places that surprise people.
That try to overturn expectations.
News stories that perhaps you won't have heard anywhere else and the things to look out for in the future.
The global news podcast helps you catch up with our restless world in your own time.
Search for it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.